Okay, so I want to mainly today, if I can, focus on just one small part of the Buddha's biography, and hopefully I can draw out this whole second great stage of the spiritual life from that. So let's go back to the Buddha. In a way, we're going back further than that. We're going back to Siddhartha, not to the enlightened Buddha. The word Buddha is a title. It means the awake, or literally it means awake. So when we talk about the Buddha, we're talking about an enlightened human being. So now I want to talk about his pre-enlightened life. I want to talk about Siddhartha. So so far, those of you who are here know that I talked about the four sights. So you have to imagine this young man, at least according to tradition, with a wife and child. Don't get too hung up on that, because nobody really knows. In fact, in the oldest sculptures of the Buddha leaving home, there's no wife and child. And so we don't know, so don't get too hung up on that. But according to tradition, there he's with his wife and child. His mother's died when he was born. His father in the castle, in the palace with him. He's a remarkably healthy, vigorous, active, deep-thinking, full-hearted, physically fit man. He's a healthy, happy human being. He's a genuinely grown-up person. And I was trying to say in the last 2 weeks that we need to emulate Siddhartha first in that. That we need to work at becoming a happy, healthy human being. Someone who has matured their self-awareness. Children's self-awareness is very limited. And what growing up means, largely, is a maturing of self-awareness. With children, you have to be their awareness for them. You have to remind them to go to the loo before they go on a long journey, and so forth. You have to get them to eat sometimes, and that sort of thing. Because they're not aware that if they haven't gone to the loo now, you know, you won't be able to get, you'll be out of the drive before they need to go to the loo. They can't predict themselves like that. They can't take responsibility for themselves like that. They can't be aware that if I don't eat now, I'm going to get really bad-tempered any minute now. And the reason I'm actually uncomfortable is because I'm hungry. So parents have to become the child's awareness for them. They have to say, no, now we eat. Now we go to the loo before we go out. Yeah. But what you're trying to do as a human being, you're trying to grow up into more and more awareness, so that you don't need anybody else around to say, have you gone to the loo yet? Actually, some of us still need that. Sometimes when I go on retreat, Parambandhu has to say, have you packed warm clothing? Because if it's sunny, I have this absurd bout of optimism, which is unusual for me, where I think the sun will come out tomorrow. You know, I think it'll be here forever, and I forget to pack warm clothing, even though I'm going to Norfolk, which is renowned for its rain. Yeah. So we're trying to mature, aren't we, in self-awareness, so that we are that rare thing, that grown-up human being, emotionally positive, someone who can feel deeply, someone who can think clearly. I don't think it means anybody intellectual in the modern debased sense. I think there is a very fine sense of being intellectual, but in the modern, rather debased sense, it doesn't mean that. It's unlikely that the Buddha could read or write. But someone who can think deeply, feel strongly, someone who can act decisively, someone who's not sort of caught up in themselves, someone who's polarized against themselves, at war with themselves, someone who wishes that they were someone else without attending to who they actually are, and so on. And that's really what we were trying to cover in the last 2 weeks. That integration means following Siddhartha in that sense, never mind following the Buddha. First of all, we need to follow in Siddhartha's footprints. Yeah. And the great point of integration is not so we can be a happy, healthy human as an end in itself, although in a sense it is, but so that we can actually see our existential predicament, so that we can really see the great problem, as I want to call it, the great problem of human life, which is that it's shot through with suffering, with old age, sickness and death. And that is the great problem of life. Problem in the fully philosophical, even religious sense, that your life, my life, has right at the core of itself a problem, a great problem, and the aim of human life, the only truly noble thing to do with human life, is to set about solving that great problem. And so often what we do is we brush it aside, cover it over, pretend it's not there, act as if we'll live forever, and so on. Much of what we call ordinary human life is pretending that we don't have a great problem. But we have the greatest possible problem, especially in as much as we're going to die, and we don't know when that's going to happen. The thing we least want to happen will happen, and we don't know when. How big a problem do you want? You can't get bigger than that, yeah? So Siddhartha, according to tradition, goes out. He sees, as we know, an old person, a sick person, and finally a dead person. And he really sees them. So he sees that there is that great problem. And the reason he sees it is because he's an integrated person. He doesn't just cognitively assent to it. He doesn't just notice it with a kind of small part of his cerebral cortex. He actually really sees it, doesn't he? So that's where we... And then finally he sees the fourth sight. He sees a wandering holy man, which represents, as I said in the last 2 weeks, a vision. And it literally is, I think, a vision, not an idea, not a worked out theory, not a philosophy, but a momentary vision of a possible solution to old age, sickness and death. Not a mock solution, not a pretend solution, not cryogenics or whatever, but a real solution to the problems of life and death. He sees it for a moment, then it disappears. Traditionally it's said he's seen the monk moving through a wandering holy man, moving through the crowd, then he disappears. Wonderful symbol for a momentary sense of not only a solution to the great problem of life, but actually, more importantly in a sense, a path to that solution. But then it goes, it's gone. And he's back in the palace again. And I imagine him coming back to the palace racked with these questions. He actually has seen the great problem. And he's seen it because he's so integrated, because he's so healthy and human. He's not all kind of segmented within himself. So his seeing affects the whole of him. He's seen that, and he's seen even a glimpse of a solution. And he must have even thought, did I really see that? Did I make that up? Could there possibly be a solution? Or is that just me wishing there to be? Would I just like there to be? And I imagine him agonising on this. You can imagine him not being able to sleep, walking up and down the palace at night. And probably he felt that this palace that he was living in, which was built to give him every pleasure, this palace suddenly seemed completely hollow and empty, completely sort of meaningless. And he probably felt, not only was it hollow and meaningless, but felt like a prison. It was like a prison of pretense. I don't know if anyone's ever been on television. I was on television, I more claim to fame. And I thought it was great, quite a good-natured atmosphere. But what I felt is nothing real was happening. It was a conspiracy of charm. We were all saying charming things and being charming and being interesting and charming. And the director, I remember, coming out and saying, "We need more noise, there's not enough noise, and people need to clap more," and so on. So then he went back and we carried on with our conspiracy of charm. And it wasn't negative, it wasn't bad, I didn't think. It just had no real content. This was breakfast television, so I'm not running a sway through all possible television programmes, some of which are very good, but you see what I mean. So I think Siddhartha must have felt his pleasure palace like that. So there were all these colours, beautiful things, beautiful clothes, beautiful people, but it just meant nothing. It sudden emptied of all of its allure because he'd seen through it. And he'd even glimpsed that there was a possible solution to it, but only glimpsed, yeah. And then in the dead of night he decides. One night, I don't know what happened, he might have woken up and just think. And somehow a decision has been made. It's like this with our deepest decisions, isn't it? We think about them, we talk about them, we go over them in our mind, and one day we notice a decision has been made. It's not been made with our rational mind, it's not been made with our thinking. Thinking never makes decisions. All that thinking can do is tell you in detail about the options. You can never make decisions on that level. You then have to wait for the decision to arise, and you can never quite say where it arises from. Real decisions don't come from your reasoned mind. They're not unreasonable, it's just they're not thought into. Suddenly they've appeared, sometimes against your reasoned mind. I remember when I was talking to somebody about why I hadn't asked for ordination. This was a long time ago, when I was about 25 or something. And I was going for this walk with this friend of mine, and I was giving this very clear reason why I hadn't asked for ordination. And as I was talking about why I hadn't, I felt this terrible uprising of, I'm going to ask for ordination, I'm going to ask for ordination, I'm going to do it, shut up, get down. You know, it was like, something was awakening in me, and I felt, I said, no, I've just got my life all right. And I had, at that moment. I remember thinking, no, I've just got my life just fine. Like, I'd got this boat, and I was a bit bad at paddling, and now I've got better at it, and now the lake is quite quiet, and peaceful moment. And just as I was doing that peaceful moment, suddenly I decided I should stand up and start waving my arms around. You know? That's how it felt. I kept on saying, sit down, you fool! You know? It was really quite peculiar, because I was literally arguing against why I decided not to ask. And as I was, I just knew that I was going to. But the decision came from somewhere else. It didn't come from what I wanted, even in my... what I wanted, frankly, was a cosy, pleasant life. I've always wanted that. I want to have a good time. That's what I've always wanted. I've never been in the slightest bit interested in religion or anything serious. I just want to have a good time. Unfortunately, life is such that it kind of says, okay, that's fine. To do that, you need to go on this journey with the Buddha. It's the only way it'll work. And I sort of gradually, hopefully less and less reluctantly, followed him instead of just thinking, yes, but I just want to have a good time. Yeah? So decisions can come from nowhere, they just arise, and perhaps that was probably how it was for Siddhartha. One night he woke up and he just knew that the decision had been made. And he went and woke his charioteer, and he said, saddle me the horse. According to a lovely tradition, he has this white stallion, a very beautiful horse called Kantaka, a beautiful horse. There must be something in that, this white. So you have to imagine, this is now the dead of night. He goes and wakes his charioteer. Remember, the charioteer is called Chanda or Chandaka, which means interest. So he wakes up his interest again. In the middle of the night, he wakes up his interest. And he tells his interest to go and saddle a horse, this beautiful white horse. And he's decided to leave. Yeah? He's decided to leave. And he knows that nobody will understand. He just knows that immediately. As soon as you know, you just think, no one's going to get this. People think I'm being selfish. They think I'm being irresponsible. They think I'll be being an impossible dreamer. If I try and explain it, they won't get it. They won't see what I'm trying to do. The more I explain it, the more they won't be able to understand. And anyway, I don't know that I can bear it. According to the story, he goes into his wife's bedroom and just looks at his wife and son sleeping, quietly breathing. And you can imagine this sense that to wake them, he just couldn't bear it. It would have broken his heart. To wake his father and say, look, I've got to go. And I can't explain it to you, but I've got to go. This isn't it. Somehow he knew that the solution to the world lay beyond the world. That the solution to the great problem of life lay beyond the world. He could not stay. And it wasn't that he decided to go on some heroic quest with a band of knights. It wasn't that he decided to follow some grand idea that he'd cooked up in his mind, some great big thing he was going to do. I'm going to go and start a religion. It wasn't even that he was swept away on the sort of waters of feeling. He just woke up and he knew he had to go. There was no question, he had to go. And then he leaves, goes into the courtyard, and Chandaka brings this incredible white stallion into the courtyard, and Siddhartha gets on it. And it's this really strange thing that suddenly everything is silent. This incredible silence falls on the palace. It's as if the whole of nature holds its breath. As if suddenly everything... And there's just this silence. And what's strange about this silence is suddenly you can't hear the hooves of the horse anymore. Imagine this incredible ringing sound in the courtyard on the flagstones of the horse's hooves. Suddenly you can't hear them anymore. Suddenly nothing moves, nothing creaks, nobody stirs. There's just this incredible silence. And according to tradition, devas, who are just means beings of light, they're sort of angel-like beings, they all came down and they put their hands under the hooves of the horses. So as the horse moved, each time the horse stepped, they put their hands underneath the hooves to stop them making any sound, these hands. And according to the story, all the gods fell asleep, as if they were under a magic spell. What seemed to have happened is that the Buddha's father in this story, and the stories have got this incredible truth to them, not a literal truth necessarily, but a credible truth. The Buddha's father had seen the tumultation, the tumultuous sort of state of mind Siddhartha was in. He'd seen it, and he could see him thinking. So often religion wants to stop people thinking. So easily, if we're not careful, we try and stop each other thinking, especially thinking about the great problem. We think, well, no, just do something else, don't think about that. And so he posts these guards around the exits to be doubly careful that the Siddhartha doesn't leave. And then they fall asleep. In this incredible silence, they fall asleep. I imagine them, you know, with their spears leaning on the wall, with their helmets on the floor, just asleep by the gates. And then silently, quietly, Siddhartha on Kantaka on his horse, followed by Chandaka. He follows him, interestingly. They go towards the gate, and the gate opens as if by magic. This huge gate that has been bolted and locked against departure just gets thrown open. And then he's gone. Siddhartha is gone. And you have to imagine the kind of dark we're going into. This isn't a dark of London, this isn't even a dark of English countryside. It's the ultra dark of India. It's the no light for miles and miles and miles. And it's a darkness of the forest that he goes into. And he goes with his white horse into the dark. You have to almost imagine seeing him and Kantaka following behind. According to tradition, Chandaka was weeping to see his master go. You see these two figures in silence go off into the dark, and you just see the white of that horse just disappearing, and then just the dark and just the sleeping palace. So Siddhartha's going forth, as it's traditionally called. I've been writing about it just today and yesterday, and I once think it was the archetype of departure. The archetype of departure. In the sense of, this is Siddhartha leaving the world irrevocably and forever. So it's the archetype of departure. It's when you leave, completely leave. Yeah? It's not a leaving to come back. It's a complete leaving of the world. He leaves everything behind. He leaves his wife, his child, his father, his palace, his kingdom. He leaves everything that he could have lived for behind. He was a man who had everything, you have to imagine, and he leaves it all behind. He just leaves. In the dead of night, he just leaves. So this is the archetype of departure. And we need to follow Siddhartha into that dark. We need to follow Siddhartha towards the archetype of departure. I want to sort of spend most of my time sort of fleshing out what I mean by that. It needs to be read symbolically, but not too symbolically, if you see what I mean. So one of the things that I was reflecting on when I was writing about it is that, in my understanding of the story, this is where suddenly all these magical, supernatural events take place. They actually do, some of them do take place at the birth of Siddhartha, but for me they never sort of stay in my mind very much, which makes me wonder. There's something about the archetypal, the imaginal. If you've not touched it, it doesn't stay. It sort of goes, you know. There are all kinds of sort of stories, mythical stories about the birth, but I sort of almost struggle to remember. They don't stay. They don't seem to have a purchase. They don't seem to resonate. But in this moment, suddenly they appear. All these angel-like figures, the devas, appear. Suddenly there's a magic spell being cast so that the guards are asleep. Suddenly his father never turns in his sleep, so he sleeps soundly. Suddenly the gates fly open. So I thought this is very interesting, that this is the moment when the mythic appears, where the angels appear. Again and again through the Buddha's life story, there are key moments in the Buddha's life where this kind of thing happens. Supernatural events, gods appear, nature spirits appear, devas appear, angels appear. The earth, nature itself, seems to cooperate. Sometimes there's earthquakes, for instance. Sometimes there's this incredible quiet. So obviously it's saying that this is a centrally important moment. This is this archetype of departure. What it's trying to say, I think, is this is of universal significance. Yeah? That the reason why the devas appear, they're not just a kind of charming embellishment to the facts of the story. They're telling you about the meaning of the story. And that meaning is universal. It's universal in two ways. It's universal in the sense that it means as much for us now as it does for him then. It's universal in it means it's for everyone always. That's what universal means. And it's universal in the sense it's complete. It's internally universal. It's a complete event. It's happening on every level of the person that it happens to. It's happening in their thought, it's happening in their heart, it's happening in their action. It's happening at this mythic level that flows through us all, which I feel more and more to be real. That we're living also a mythic life. Very difficult to talk about because it's so easy to get sentimentalised or rarefied. But something, it seems to me, is as if life is working a pattern through us. Let's leave it at that for now. So you've got this archetype of departure, and it's meaning something for us here and now, for everybody, always, and it's about a complete experience. Yeah? But what I thought was interesting is that the devas appear now. They don't appear when the Buddha Siddhartha sees the sights. It's interesting, isn't it? I don't think I've ever read any account of he sees an old person and the deva, because sometimes the devas shout to all the other devas above them saying, this is happening, you know. There's one moment particularly where they shout and the shout goes on higher and higher and higher. So they don't seem to appear, they don't seem to be especially interested. They don't appear at the appearance of the old person, of the sick person, of the dead person. They don't even appear, as far as I'm aware, in the seeing of the sight of the wandering holy man. There's no earth shaking, there's no ground holding its breath, there's no magic, there's no doors open, just this sight. So that's very striking, isn't it? And what I take that to mean is the sights aren't the sights until they're acted upon. The sights aren't the sights until they're acted upon. The only way you know they're real sights is if you do something about them. Yeah. So until that moment, the universe didn't know whether it meant anything very much. The universe didn't need to shake in 4,000 ways, as it's sometimes described, because it's not an unusual event. So all of us, many of us, see the sight to some degree. I've met people and I've read about people who definitely had sometimes a terrifying vision of the great problem of life, that life has suffering woven into it and has old age, sickness and death. You meet people, I talked about the other day about the philosopher Brian McGee writing about it with great knowledge. It was really like reading the sutra for a while as he talked about this experience of the sites, the three sites, interestingly. But quite clearly it was a sort of insight-like experience. I've also met a lot of people, I've even had my own moments myself, where you do actually have a vision of the goal. It's not uncommon. It's not uncommon to see the wandering holy man for a moment. I've had a moment of it myself, even perhaps more than one. And many people come to the centre, come to Buddhism, because they have caught a glimpse of something. It's not that uncommon. Neither of those things are that uncommon. But usually what happens is we go back to the palace. Usually, and remember last week I was saying the palace also represents symbolically our habitual mindset. The usual, everyday, same old me. Usually, it almost inevitably, that takes over again, doesn't it? We see for a moment the predicament we're in, the great predicament we're in. Sometimes even we get a glimpse of a solution to it, but the world is too much with us. It's not the world is too much with us, the palace is too much with us. Me is too much with us. We go back into me, myself, I again. The vision fades. We are, again, locked into the palace of the humdrum. I thought it was very striking when you think of it like this, because the guards around the palace gates become the guardians of the ordinary, the guardians of the day-to-day, the guardians of your usual mind. And they're always trying to stop you leave. The guards are always saying, no, it's fine. There's no great problem. Look, it's a really nice place here. You could always, I think there's almost a metaphor here for the so-called developed world. We've created a world, haven't we, that's a pleasure palace, and we keep saying, look, it's fine in here. I know it's horrible out there, but don't worry, if you think too much about out there, it'll start to upset you. So you're fine in here, yeah? It's whatever keeps us into our usual, habitual, day-to-day, conventional, important mind, yeah? The guards are trying to keep us in that mindset. And usually that's what happens. We, like Siddhartha, we venture out of that occasionally, and we see life a bit. Life actually touches us, even grazes us for a moment, but it's too much. So we go back, and we go back into the ordinary, into the known, into the usual, into the habitual, into the conventional, both personally and interpersonally, both in terms of myself and in terms of my relationship with you. Both literally and metaphorically, we stay at home. Sometimes people do literally stay at home. In fact, more and more people seem to be staying at home now. It's not good for you. So it's interesting, isn't it? So I think the devas appear because what it's saying is that the true measure of perception is action. The true measure of seeing is action. So we know that the Buddha really saw and really felt what he saw because he did something. He changed his life. That's how we know it meant something. He changed his life. So this is the great moment for us. And this takes us into this second great stage of spiritual life. It means we need to change our life to some degree. Probably none of us, at least possibly none of us, can follow the Buddha, Siddhartha, right out into the darkness. But we need to follow it to some degree. We need to change our life. The only way in which we know that what I've been saying about today, what you've done here at this Buddha Centre, has affected you, is to the degree to which you've changed your life. Otherwise, it frankly doesn't mean very much. That's why the devas don't appear, why the gates don't open, why magic doesn't happen. It's because they don't know whether you mean it yet. It's only when you act that they know that you mean it. So I think this is very interesting. So it means that this second great stage of spiritual life is a stage of action. The first great stage of spiritual life is a stage of, you could say, self-knowledge, of gathering, of self-knowing, of collecting, of taking 100% responsibility for our lives. Crikey, that's difficult enough. Really living from ourselves, from within ourselves, not blaming other people for how we are, not thinking, if you didn't do that, I wouldn't do this. And so on. It's so very difficult, isn't it? Gosh, I still feel I'm really struggling with that now. God, dear, never mind the second stage. Anyway, you know, that just simple sense of collecting, being grown up, taking full responsibility. This is my life. This is what I do with my life. This is the suffering I create. Yeah. It's the joy I create as well, the suffering I create. But the second great stage is, okay, now I'm going to do something about life. It's not enough just to be happy, healthy, human. It's not enough just to see things with a more integrated state. We need to then act. We're forced to act. So the degree we act is the degree to which we genuinely feel something. So this leads us on to Bhante's title for this stage, which is the stage of positive emotion. You know, positive emotion. I want to kind of look at both of those words in a minute, but the first thing I want to say is the way we know something is positive emotion is if it makes us act. Yeah? If it makes us act. In fact, the way where you know it's genuine emotion is if it makes you act. Never mind positive. It's if it makes you act, isn't it? If it makes you do things. If it doesn't make you act, it doesn't count. If it doesn't make you act, it's what's called sentimental emotion. So for instance, it's striking that we have such thing as sentimental pity. We have sentimental love, and we even have sentimental indignation, don't we? We can have times where we get really indignant about something, whether things done to us, or things done to other people, or even things done to the planet. We get really, really indignant about it, and are rather proud of it. You can sometimes see people sort of bristling with indignation. It's really quite unpleasant, actually. It's very easy to do, very easy to slip into doing. But you see what I mean? You can have a sentimental indignation, you can have sentimental pity. Oh dear, oh isn't it terrible? Oh. sentimental of, I love you, you know. But the way you know it's sentimental is if you don't really do anything about it. So, sentimental feeling is really feeling that you want to have. And better still, you want to be caught with having. Is it what I mean? So you want, it's a social emotion, in other words. You want to show people how large-hearted you are, how concerned you are for justice, or how deeply moved you are by the downtrodden, by the plight of the downtrodden. And mainly that's what you're interested in. You're interested in other people admiring you for those things, actually. It sounds terrible when you sort of say it out loud, but we all do that, don't we? Oh, isn't that awful? Oh, yes, that's so terrible. And then someone said, are you going to do anything? But I said, I hadn't thought of that, no. it's really quite shaming, isn't it, in a certain sort of way, when you really think about it. So many of the things we get into a lather about, but we've no intention of actually doing anything about them. Yeah. So you can see that sentimental emotion leads to betrayal. So if your friend emotes about you and says, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, that must be very, very difficult. Say your partner's just left you, and oh, that sounds really, really difficult. I'm really sorry to hear that. Oh, how dreadful. And then they say, gosh, you know, I'm on my own on Friday night. Could you come round? It'd be really nice to have some company. And they say, well, actually, I'm seeing my partner that night. you see what I mean? So suddenly, oh, I don't actually mean to actually do anything about it. Especially I don't need to inconvenience myself about it. So do you see how it leads to betrayal? So you can really think, oh gosh, somebody really cares for me here. So when I ring them up and want to chat, they'll say, actually, I'm really busy just now. That sounds dreadful. Or something. Now, it's easy to think about that as other people doing that. But we often do something like that. In some way, don't we? It might not be so crude as that, but we do, don't we? I do, anyway. I find myself feeling things, but underneath that, I don't intend to do anything. So that's what's called sentimental emotion. And the proof of it is that we don't have any such thing as sentimental spite, for instance. No one brags about their spitefulness. Interestingly, you don't have such thing as sentimental depression either, because nobody will admire you for it. That's one of the difficult things about being depressed, and I've been quite depressed in my life at times, is that people start to avoid you, or they can do. They don't admire you for it. They don't like it. You're a bit of a downer. So that the reason we don't have a sentimental version of those things is because nobody admires you for it. So I think this is a very... When we start to look at the Buddha's life story, Siddhartha's life story, it makes it much clearer what positive emotion means. So positive emotion is emotion that leads you to act, which is me, as distinct from sentimental emotion, which is really emotion you like to have and you like to be seen having. Yeah. We all do it on some degree, and I mean us all probably. Very, very difficult to avoid. One of the only people I know who studiously avoids it is Bhante, my teacher, Sangrachita. It can be quite shocking sometimes, because he just won't do it. And he won't do it to you, you know what I mean? So I just recently went to see him, and he's very elderly now. And I only could see him for half an hour, and at the end of my meeting with him, I grasped his hand. And I said, "Oh, Bhante, I just want to thank you again one more time." Bhante is my beloved teacher. I feel so fortunate to have a teacher, not a teacher with a small T, but a teacher. Fancy having a teacher. I come from a place called Henley in Arden. Nobody had a teacher. It's unthinkable. To have a teacher, somebody that I can love as a teacher. I still find it incredible to have a teacher. So anyway, I grasped his hand and I said, "I just want to thank you one more time." I said, "Look, I just don't know what would have happened to my life had I not met you." And he looked at me and just said, "Oh yes, it doesn't bear thinking about." I laughed out loud. I was really struck by it, because most people slightly preen. Or they say something mock humble, don't they? They say, "Oh no, I'm sure you've been, you know, I'm sure you'd have found," blah, blah, blah. He just said, "Oh yes, it doesn't bear thinking about." a complete lack of sentimentality. It's like the window suddenly being opened. It's just to the left of your social expectations. And we should be doing that for each other, I can tell you, if we can. It was wonderful, actually, a wonderful moment, a gift. Anyway. So that's the test of our positive emotion, is whether we act, because this is the second stage, is a state of action. It's on the base, and you see how to act. We need to know ourselves. We need to be in possession of ourselves. Otherwise, our action is likely to be coming from a bright idea we've got, rather than our actual ideal, our felt ideal. It'll just be a bright ideal. Idea. Bhante makes this wonderful distinction between a bright idea and an ideal. So if we don't know ourselves deeply, we'll be just acting from an idea sometimes. Sometimes that's not so bad. Sometimes that's the best we can do. Or we'll be acting from the stories we tell about ourselves, rather than about them from our actual experience. Or we'll be acting because other people around us are acting in that way. As I said in my announcements, I think we need to be much more aware of how deeply influenced we are by other people. And there's no place of no influence, including here. I'm trying to influence you now. And when you leave here and go to the pub is trying to influence you as well. Especially if it's trying to influence you to drink more. I noticed the other day I watched on television, there was somebody, some rather dubiously tanned middle-aged man, exhorting the value of online poker. I really thought he should be ashamed to be taking that job. I thought it was absolutely shocking. Just and this sort of little, you know, I just think, but this is like deeply, deeply unhealthy, yeah? But we can start saying, "Oh, that's quite normal." Actually, for me it was shocking because I don't see television very much. And had it been on television, you know, 20 years ago when I was, it would have been shocking then. But before we know it, it'll be quite normal. Then we'll have, you know, join my pornography site, and then we'll have, you know, what's that game again, Adam?
Grand Theft Auto.
Grand Theft Auto again, you know, do this more, you know. And, thank you, Adam. I can never seem to quite remember it, but I've never played it, as you can imagine. But, you know, these things are pernicious, aren't they? And they really just are. They're horrible. But before we know, we're all just sort of thinking a little, that's just fine. They've done some research. I was talking about this in the soft tape last night, and you don't really need it to know this, but they've done some research on violent video games. For instance, what happens is people do violent video games, then they go to adult video games, and that's how squaddies learn to shoot people. Then they do video games about shooting people, then guess what, they actually get to shoot people. That's how they train now. That's how they train squaddies. They've done some research on it, and that what they seem to be showing is that children who play violent video games are less sensitive to real violence than children that don't. Of course, what's happening is the people who make those games are pouring shedload of money into research to show that that isn't the case. But it's disgraceful. Even if it's half pie true, even if it's a quarter pie true, we can't be that. Well, that can't be the world. People talk about the real world. That can't be the real world. What are we doing? But before we know it, okay, you're in your... I see this woman very happily reading 50 Shades of Grey. I say, madam, it's a thief! Like a sort of Protestant minister. Anyway, I won't go on about it. I thought you'd sound President Morrison. But you see what I mean? We create this world, and before we know, we habituate to it. We think that adverts about poker, which can destroy people's lives, just as adverts about smoking can kill people in the worst possible way, we start to sort of think that's kind of all right. And it's all right to make your money out of doing that. And that's a fine thing to do. And if you're an actor, guess what, you get a job to promote people to destroy life, and that's kind of fine. And people get very worried about the ominous industry and people working in that. Do you see what I mean? We habituate to a world. Yeah? So this stage of practice is about leaving that habituated world. There's a communal aspect to that, and I'll come on to that next week. I've said much more than I meant to. So positive emotion is emotion that's leaving that kind of world behind. It's leaving a lower world, a habituated, smaller world, a narrow world, even if it's a gorgeously decorated narrow world, like Siddhartha's Paris. It's leaving that behind for something more like reality, something more like truth, something more like a decent way of behaving to other people. That's what it's really doing. That's what this stage is really doing. It's saying, tell you what, this really isn't very good, this way of treating people. And that's saying in every sphere, politically, socially, culturally, but especially the Buddha's saying you, your action to that person just then, the way you spoke just then, the way you did that just then, the way you go on about how you've been a victim of other people. Do you see that's really not helpful? You've got to leave that behind. So at the very least, this stage of positive emotion is leaving the me at the centre of everything, but behind a bit. At the very least, it's doing that, yeah. It's saying, okay, I need to leave that behind. I need to leave behind this habituated world that seems all right because we all kind of approve of it in some weird way, and as much as you can watch television and be unmoved by it, unshocked by it in the positive sense, and not in the kind of moral, sort of pseudo-moral sense. So let me say a bit more about positive and emotion, because both of those words are a bit problematic. So the first thing I'm saying is that this is a stage of action. And action is the real test of genuine positive emotion. Otherwise we fall back into the problem of sentimental emotion. To act genuinely, we need to act with the whole of ourself, and that means we need to be integrated. So we need to practice the first stage. The stage of integration, and we need to keep on practicing that, because it's often when you act that you realise how unintegrated you are, isn't it? You can go on retreat, you have this incredible sense of inspiration, and then a week later you feel like you're back where you started. You realise how unintegrated you are. So remember, all of these stages are not just stages but aspects. Very often you're being told there's not enough integration, and you're going to be told that all the way up to full and perfect enlightenment. There's more to integrate here. You know, you're still not complete here. Yeah. But as a path, we start with this self-knowledge, being who we are, being fully ourselves, without being riven by guilt, without being riven by a conventional morality that outlaws aspects of our experience when we need to embrace them, and so on. On the basis of a genuine self-awareness, not an idea, not a view, we need to act. And we need to act on the basis of positive emotion. we need to move towards the truth, we need to move towards a decent way of being in the world, an honourable way of living in the world, of treating each other, of treating the planet, not as an ideology, but as an actually felt thing. And that's what this second great stage is really trying to communicate. So when we talk about positive and emotion, we need to be careful of those two words. So the word positive can either sound a bit thin, so it sounds like people say, oh, you need to have a more positive approach. I was reading about Pret-a-Manger, a really shocking article actually about Pret-a-Manger, and they've got this positive thing, and you have to be really positive to work there, and your colleagues will actually check up on how positive you are, and they have they watch you, the people in trial, they watch you and see whether you're being positive enough, and if you're not, they mark you down, and they pay awful wages, but they're supposed to be positive. So it's not positive in that awful manufactured kind of way. People talk about having a positive approach, looking at things positively. She's so often just, in other words, don't tell the truth. I'm getting quite impassioned here. Anyway, it's not that. It's also not, positive can also just mean, sound like it's just about up, being up and bubbly and cheery. It's not that either. Yeah. It's positive in a much deeper, fuller sense. It includes being heroic, being courageous, taking risks, being resilient, learning things, being considerate, putting yourselves out, being able to bear discomfort, being sympathetic, being generous. It includes the whole gamut of trying to act in a decent human way. That's what positive means. And then of course we have this word emotion, which is a bit tricky as well, because it starts to make it sound that this second stage is all about emotion, about feeling very strongly. And again, if we're not careful, that leads us back into this problem of sentimental emotion, because you can feel sentimental emotions very strongly, but you know they're sentimental because you don't act on them. In other words, it's fake emotion, really. That's why it leads to betrayal, because they're kind of fake. And you often tell with your friends whether it's been fake emotion or not is when you're in trouble or when you're ill. Who is the one who brings a vomit bowl? Who is the one that does those things that, frankly, you don't particularly want to do and you don't want to brag about and you don't get anything from? Yeah? I mean, it's a very, very hard test, that. It's a very rigorous test of positive emotion. But that's the test, I think, that Siddhartha would apply and that Bhaktisangharakshita would apply. You see, there's such a lot to, in a way, live up to. So emotion, we must be careful we don't go down into sort of sentimental emotion. But I think what it does, and I think the reason why Bhante uses it, he really wants to stress this is a complete thing that we need to be doing here. It's not just an idea, it's not a thought experiment, it's not words that I'm good at. It's a fully emotionalized reality, you know. He famously talks that we need to find emotional equivalents to our intellectual understandings. This is a quite brilliant, genius-level perception about one of the central problems in spiritual life, is we need to find emotional equivalents to our intellectual understandings. We can know things, we can sort of see things, but the devas don't appear because we don't act on them, because we don't really know them, and especially we don't know them emotionally. Emotion, again, is not quite enough of a word because it includes your guts, your instincts, your volitions, your mythic life even. That's why I think he uses it, because he really wants to emphasise that this isn't a head trip. This isn't just something to talk about. I remember a friend of mine saying that when he talked about the Dharma, sometimes it's his most alienated discussions. And some people get into that. You can sort of talk about the spiritual life in a very heady, alienated way. Especially when you start banding around big words like non-duality is my particular one I don't like. You might have your own. There are certain things that people start talking about, and you can feel that it's actually bad for you. It'd be better to just sort of go and do some cleaning. Now, I can overemphasize this because The life of the mind is a real mind. I've had wonderful discussions about those kind of things. I remember Jan Vach and I remember that time we drove back once. And I was doing my, I don't want to talk about this because it's just stuff of nonsense. And we were getting to this really interesting discussion. I can't remember what it was about. But you know, sometimes when you're driving, you get your best talk to the friend, don't you, when you're driving. It's fantastic sometimes when you're driving. And we were driving home on the M11. I've travelled on the M11 so many times in my life, up and down to my Norfolk, which is where I often go on the trip, or to Vrasen. And we were trying to talk about the nature of reality. And between us, gradually, there we were. We were really talking about it, not just doing what they call mouse den, which is very brilliant picture, isn't it? There's always mouse Buddhism if you're not careful. But just because there is doesn't mean to say we shouldn't try to really talk. But to really talk about the real problem, the great problem, you need to really talk with your heart as well as your mind. What we're trying to get, what positive emotion is really pointing at, is I think it's better to think of it as complete action, complete thought, thought which has got emotion, emotion that has got thought. I think it would be better to think of it in that sort of way, that it's complete, yeah? But another way of talking about it, and I'll finish with this, and I think what we'll do is we'll just, again, just sit at the end, just to see where this has left us. Perhaps a more traditional way of talking about this second stage is the stage of kusala karma. Kusala, and I want to leave it untranslated, I think from now on I'll just talk in terms of kusala karma or positive emotion. But kusala means skillful, helpful, adroit, I was thinking of today. That means a skilled, intelligent, wise. It also means morally good. But I sort of want to steer away from that kind of language because there's so many misunderstandings about that. It's the fruitful, the useful, the genuinely intelligent, the skillful, the skilled way of acting, if you mean. And karma just means action. People get very confused about karma. People say, oh, that's your karma. What that means is karma viparka, and viparka means the results of your action. So karma literally just means action. And it means action either in terms of your body, your speech, or your mind. Yeah? So kusala karma is a stage of skillful, intelligent, fruitful, adroit action. Decent action. Honourable action. It's that stage. It's when we try to act more and more in that kind of way, on the basis of knowing ourselves, on the basis of seeing how ourselves are patterned by our life. I was saying last week about how my reactions to other people are patterned by my history, by my psychology, and that means that my capacity to be objective is sometimes badly skewed. There's a bit of it in there, but there's often too much of me. I can tell because I get all heated up. Deary me. And I get very heated up, you know. Because so there's something I'm trying to say, and there's also something I need to learn about me and the kind of patterning that my thought is brought to my life, which is to me. So we need that. That's a part of the integration. Learning more and more about yourself, so that you can judge better, actually, so that you can judge more wisely, so you can act more fully and more genuinely in the interest of others. Yeah. So that's where I want to finish this evening. I've tried to link it all, take off from Siddhartha's leaving, this archetype of departure, because we need to follow him. If we're going to practice the spiritual life to any degree, there's no way but to follow him. Even if that just means a tiny letting go of the habit of being me, my usual little world that I create for myself. But as I said, it also really means a change of your life. And that means an internal change, but it nearly always, in fact, pretty much inevitably, means an external change. Without external change, internal change usually just goes back, doesn't it? Without something to show you that your life is now different, usually your life is the same. So I'm saying at the start, you don't want to read this too symbolically, but you don't want it to read it too literally. So it doesn't necessarily literally mean, obviously, leaving behind your sleeping wife and child or your elderly father. But it does mean a real change. I might try and say something about that more next week, but perhaps we'll leave it at that. So what I want to do just now is just close it, just set yourself up into meditation. Just when you're ready, closing your eyes. And just as we did in the beginning of the evening, just come back down to your heart center, which is the seat of your emotions. Just see whether you can feel and notice what you feel there. Whatever it is. You don't need to analyze it or think about it. Just see if you can notice what you're left with just now. so that's all we've got time for today. So if you could put your cushions and mats at the side, and then we'll leave this room silent and we can talk as soon as you're out. So I'll see you next week, hopefully.